Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, research points to a likely burial site of Paiute children who attended a Utah indigenous boarding school. A Mormon apostle stirs controversy by criticizing BYU faculty who challenged the faith's teachings on same-sex marriage. And a Utah school board member draws fire for posting a message critical of LGBTQ students at a Utah high school. Those and other stories on the docket today. And joining me for this conversation, we've got via Zoom, Salt Lake Tribune, Southern Utah reporter Alistair Lee-Bitsoy. And good morning, Alistair. Thanks for being here.
Yes, good morning. How are you?
Great, thank you. And I really appreciate your joining us for your inaugural episode of the show. And also on the Zoom, we've got Salt Lake Tribune editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. And good morning to you, George.
Good morning.
And just a little bit later, we will also hear from Tribune religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. So stay tuned for that. Listeners, join us with your questions or comments. You can tweet them to @KCPW, and we'd love to get those addressed for you. Alistair Lee-Bitsoy, you and your colleague Courtney Tanner reported a story this week that uncovered some difficult history from a town in southern Utah. The headline reads, Paiute children are believed to be buried at site of former Utah Indigenous boarding school. This is in the town of Panguitch in Garfield County. And Alistair, where does this information come from? Meaning, how do we know that the bodies of Paiute children are possibly buried at this site?
Thank you again. I'm actually right now in Panguitch. Oh, wow. I came down to Panguitch to find out more of what is happening on the ground with the story that we, Courtney and I, published this past week in the Salt Lake Tribune. And there, where the story comes from, actually, I've learned through this research we've done with Courtney, is it comes from the community. It comes from the former historic preservation, not the former, but the current historic preservation officer / marketing / event planner for the city of Panguitch, Stephen Lee. And then Tamara Borshaw Clayton, who's a chairperson for the Indian Peaks Band of the Paiute Indians. And then just talking to Karina Bow. She's the chairwoman of the Paiute Indian Tribe of Utah. And so how I came across this story was when I was in Cedar City last month, making my debut as a Southern Utah reporter, breaking news on the flooding.
Yeah.
And I just picked up the phone and just started to ask Karina Bow, who's the chairwoman of her people, like, how's the flooding like impacted the Paiute, the Cedar Band Paiutes in Cedar City? And so like that kind of just started opening the door to other stories related to Southern Utah, and including the Panguitch Indian boarding school story.
Yeah. And it's
and a, so that yeah. sorry.
No, no, I don't mean to
go
cut,
ahead.
I mean, I don't mean to cut you off. That's where the story comes from. And I guess part of what Karina Bow tells you is that there's this, I mean, that the tribe basically knows, has this oral history and has known for a while that, that they believe that there are children buried there. Maybe before we go into this, we should talk about what this school was and who attended it. Or, you know, I know that this was kind of forced attendance, really, and it's kind of part of a bigger story as well of Native American boarding schools in the United States. But can you just tell us what this school was and how long it operated, maybe?
Yeah, so it did start off as a Presbyterian school. So the first superintendent was from the Presbyterian Church. And then the second superintendent was Runke, who is, by the way, not a great man at all by any means. And it operated in the early like 1900s for like a not like maybe a couple 4 to 5 years. So I got to double check that again, my research, but it operated in some, most of the students were from the Kaibab band of in Arizona, and then and they were mostly from the Shivitz band of the Paiute tribe of Utah. And so those were the students that mostly were the student body at this school.
Go ahead.
No, we're still learning as we go to explore this story. So it's still developing, it's still evolving. And I think the story definitely centers on just like this is like the earliest forms of colonization to indigenous native people in America. And I've learned with Courtney that this story or the findings that are happening now actually happened before the Canadian findings. So the Paiute Indian tribe was well aware of this for a long time.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like hadn't been out to the masses until like Monday.
And there was this, you're talking about the mass graves that were found at a Canadian indigenous boarding school, 182 human remains and unmarked graves. And there is that, so this has been known about for longer than that, but hasn't been focused on. But there is this effort to look at this that is coming partially from the Interior Department and from Interior Secretary Deb Haaland. Is this story going to be part of that, or is that review looking at this particular school, is Secretary Haaland's review looking at this particular school and what's happened there?
Yeah, so there is momentum with the Department of Interior through Madam Secretary Deb Haaland to look into the narrative, our historical traumas of boarding schools in America. And we felt like targeting telling the story of Pinguitch was important to just the momentum of what is happening in Canada, and then now like America making it a priority. And we felt like, I don't know if it was timing or relevancy, we just broke the story and it happened during this time.
And
according to my resources in the story, the Pinguitch school, like I said, had already, like the Paiute members already knew about this, but they didn't know if it was going to be added to the listing or priorities of the federal government. And then they had been working with the city of Pinguitch, but also had reached out to Utah State University, who now manages the land. And so they felt like maybe going through the university would be a quicker route than maybe waiting for the feds to do their investigation. But according to the story and what Courtney found there was that they are going to start the due diligence or consultation process in the fall.
Okay. And Alistair, I want to talk about what happened at Native American boarding schools generally, and at Pinguitch, I guess, in particular. I mean, the treatment at these schools is not, it's not looked on favorably. Well, I mean, it was pretty, depending upon the school, it was pretty awful, right?
Well, the thing is, like, I'm Indigenous, I'm Native, I'm Diné from the Navajo Nation. So, like, when I was given the assignment to explore this story, like, this is what I was telling, like, the conversations that were happening. Like, this is not breaking news to, like, Indigenous folks. It is to the rest of the world.
Right.
Like it was breaking news for us when we were forced to go to boarding school against our wills. And so like you see those behavior, like even today, like I realized like the trauma and the effort to heal from those behaviors that you don't see or that you now recognize or I recognize that exists in our communities. And so like, yeah, examples of historical traumas, like just being forcibly removed from your home to attend school at some point, and at gunpoint in the case of Pinguitch, like these Paiute children were, and the Navajo children were also Runke did leave after the school shut down. He did go down to the boarding school on Western Navajo Agency, and that's where he was basically had criminal acts of forgery, and he did get away with murder of a Navajo man who resisted the tactics of Runke to recruit students to go to school. So like, you have that history there, and then you have sexual abuse and emotional and physical abuse. And then you see, like, in my communication with at least my family, like, I see the habits of like getting spanked or abused. And I'm like, where is that abuse? Like, that's not a healthy way to care for children. And so like, those habits were picked up from boarding school.
Yeah. And the long trauma that goes with that. I mean, you keep referring to Walter Runke, who was the second superintendent of this school in Panguitch. It does sound like he was, doing some pretty horrendous practices. I mean, forcing people to school by gunpoint. And then later, he's arrested and indicted for murder of a Navajo man, who, again, as you said, resisted the recruitment tactics that Runke was using to try and force people to these boarding schools. Can I ask, for the children who are, believed to be buried at this school, Alistair, do we know how many, how many are actually there? Do we know how they may have died?
That's the next phase of the project. That's where I can't speak on behalf of the Paiute Indian Tribe of Utah. It is in their hands now to figure out what to do, but the oral accounts are saying at least 12 bodies. The oral history says that, even though it's not written, doesn't mean that's not necessarily true either. So that's what we're finding out. Like, a lot of our peoples love, we're natural storytellers through oral histories. And so the next phase of the story, I guess this investigative piece, is to talk to the families. But just being in Panguitch, I did learn that the Salt Lake Tribune needs to follow, and other media need to follow the guidance of the tribes involved in this particular case, but also like obey and respect their cultural protocol process to talk to their community.
Okay.
And so that's the next phase of the project. And so as we evolve, I think the numbers will get a clear number of what number of bodies are there, but there is one recorded body there already in the cemetery. So we know that that's just one of possibly many. And that's from the first superintendent, I believe, that was who's buried there.
Yeah. Who died there. Utah State University is at one point planning to use ground penetrating radar to try and determine, where and if and where there are other burial sites. And I guess I'm wondering, aside from uncovering the stories of these children and better understanding this very difficult moment in history, what is the goal here? I mean, you talked about going through the proper protocols and ensuring that you're speaking to going through the correct channels to have those conversations. But I'm wondering, from the perspective of the tribes, is it about getting the remains back, about bringing the family members home?
Yeah, I mean, in the conversations with the chairwoman and chairwoman Bo and Tamara Borshord Slayton, who is the chairwoman of her, or chairperson of her band. Like, those, it's a healing process. The community or the tribe had members of the Shivitz band and the Kaibab band in Panguitch yesterday, and they had a moment to visit the grounds, and they didn't want media there whatsoever. And so I respected that. I was like, yeah, it's still fresh. It's still new. It's still they're still trying to figure out what is happening next. Like, they're still trying to connect some of the history that's maybe missing among them as people, and just trying to trace their connections to the boarding school. And so that's just an example of like the community taking charge for this, and this is their story. And so they're going to tell it the way they want to tell it going forward. And so like from my perspective, I think it is what I would call healing and understanding and just like processing what is happening. Cause this story, it was heavy. It is heavy. And it actually did take me out as a person. I had to like step away and I'm like, are we really writing this? Or is this appropriate? Like, is this how does this need to be told?
Yeah.
And so I feel like Courtney, who I credit for the historical record for the story, and then I just talked to the community, like the sources that I know in the community that I felt like could help tell the story appropriately. And that's how the story came out.
Okay. And it's, again, I mean, it's one story of many. We just barely scratched the surface of that national review of boarding schools that's being conducted under Secretary Holland. And this is just one example of many examples of what was, you know, essentially abduction and abuse. You know, I think that the perspective, I mean, we should say that the reason that these schools came to be was to try and quote unquote, I guess, assimilate. Yeah. Do you want to talk about that?
Assimilate our people. Like the whole boarding school process, their system was to assimilate. You know, like the Carlisle, and there were students from our research that did transfer to the Carlisle Indian Boarding School and probably other boarding schools in America from the Panguitch School. And so like the motto was to say like what the Carlisle Indian School famously is known to, like, kill the Indian, save the man. I think that's correct.
Right.
But that's the theme, is to rid us, cut our hair, rid us of our culture to be more Bilagana or more white. And so these boarding schools, I would say failed. I mean, and we're happy that they failed, but it failed at the expense of our ancestors who had to undergo these traumas. And
yeah. I'm going to ask George Pyle, the editorial page editor for the newspaper that you work for. George Pyle, you're a columnist for the paper, and you know, as Alistair just said, this is just one component of a much bigger story. And I'm just wondering, give us your thoughts on this reporting and what it is showing, what it's uncovering. And George, you're on mute, by the way. Alistair, I think we George, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm on mute when I'm not supposed to be, and I'm not when I am supposed to be. So that's good. First, welcome to Alistair, to the Tribune staff. Shows the success that we're having with our new nonprofit model. We're getting enough support from the community that we're able to expand our staff, expand our reporting staff. In this case, get somebody to focus on Southern Utah and also diversify our staff in a way that's been pretty lacking up to now. So that's wonderful. On this particular story, this is the kind of thing that you know, we're having increasing amounts of understanding and reckoning with our past. All the discussions that, and a lot of it, frankly, very foolish about critical race theory and understanding the history as it involves African Americans, slavery and Jim Crow and the civil rights movement and redlining and mass incarceration and all of that. We're coming to a better understanding of that, as much resistance as we're getting. We're coming to a better understanding of the history of Indigenous Americans in the United States and Canada. I mean, they had similar problems with Indigenous people in Australia, treatment that was just as horrible. And, you know, these schools, as you say, were an attempt to, you know, just take Native peoples and turn them into white folks in a way that was just cruel. And when you find grave sites or graves, not even grave sites, you know, unmarked burials of children, even if those children weren't, you know, overtly murdered, they died in circumstances away from their home, away from their homes, away from their families. And they weren't even returned to their families. Now, you know, 150 years ago, children dying of disease of all races was not that uncommon. It happened. And sometimes you couldn't move the deceased very far because they didn't have the technology to do it that we have now. That's why we have burials in military cemeteries all over the world, is because you couldn't bring them home. But just to kind of bury them on site and not tell anybody and not even attempt to repatriate the remains and then not have an official history of what happened there is just shameful. And it's painful, but it's important that the work that the Tribune is doing, the work that that Utah State University is doing, moves forward. So we can't really make this up to anybody, but at least try and face the facts and
understand the past.
Get everything out there on the record and understand the past.
And how it impacts the present. Alistair, just before we move on to other stories, which I know we need to do here in terms of time, but I know that you've been down at the site of the school, as you said, and I was wondering if you might just tell us what it's like. What does it look like? And are there any vestiges of the facility that used to be there, this school?
Well, yeah, I was underground yesterday. In an effort to find out more. And I felt like what I saw was a lot of the, there's just one remaining building or home or house or structure there. Mm-hmm. And then most of the lay of the land is like, it's like alfalfa hayland, like cattle were also grazing on the grasses there. Mm-hmm. And it's also like the Sevier River runs through what would be the campus or the former campus or farm. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it just was a different experience just being on the land and just seeing and maybe even thinking like, what if we're on the grave, like right now, or like, right, since they're unmarked or there's other, it was a little bit interesting for me to see or reimagine what happened there.
Wow. This is reporting done by Alistair Lee-Bitsoy and Courtney Tanner in the Salt Lake Tribune. It goes very deep, and I encourage everyone to go and check it out. It's, as Alistair said, it's replete with historic documents and oral histories and personal accounts, and you can find it at sltrib.com. Alistair, before we head to a break, anything else you want to add? I mean, there's a ton from the story that we didn't get to that is in the reporting, and so I'll urge people to go there, but any final thoughts here before we move on?
Yeah, I just want to thank you, KCPW, and just the audience that listens this morning or to this show, and to George, and just the opportunity to elevate and tell the truths of Indigenous people in Utah and their narratives, because our narratives exist and they have been. And so I'm glad now, as a Southern Utah reporter, I'm able to tell some of these stories that are appropriate. And I probably won't tell all of them just because some of them don't need to be told. But I'm glad to add to the team. And again, we do offer, Courtney and I are going to continue to follow this story. And I believe we are a nonprofit, as I know, as a newspaper. So please donate to the Salt Lake Tribune so that we begin to investigate the rest of this story, which has been dark, but also like healing, but also very fascinating at the same time.
All right. Alistair Lee-Bitsoy is Southern Utah reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. And again, check out that reporting at sltrib.com. We need to head to our first break in the show, but there is still more to come from this past week in Utah news, including the statements by an apostle with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints that stirred up a bit of controversy. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Nick Forster. This week in E-Town, we are going to revisit a show from our 1997 season that features musical guests Iris DeMent and Cliff Eberhardt, plus my conversation with President Jimmy Carter. That's this week in E-Town.
Tune in Saturday evening at 7 here on Utah Public Radio.
Support for Utah Public Radio programming comes from our members and Stokes Nature Center Canyon Jams, presenting Swinging Lights, September 3rd at 7 p.m., located at Von Bear Park in Providence. Information at logannature.org/canyonjams. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on Utah Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. Coming up at 10 o'clock, we have UPR Presents with The Moth Following at 11.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Alistair Lee-Bitsoy and editorial page editor George Pyle. It's our live Friday morning Utah News Review, and you can join us with your questions and comments by tweeting them to @KCPW. And actually, right now, we are going to turn to my conversation with Peggy Fletcher Stack, Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter, about some comments that an apostle of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints made at a conference at Brigham Young University earlier this week that were about what that institution, BYU, is and what this church official thinks it should be. Take a listen. Peggy Fletcher Stack, religion reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, as always, thank you for being here.
Always a pleasure.
There has been quite a bit of uproar and debate over a statement that was made this week by a Latter-day Saint apostle at a Brigham Young University conference. This is Elder Jeffrey Holland. Peggy, can you just tell us the comments that he made that stirred up all of this debate? Especially, I've seen it on, you know, the sort of social media sphere, but elsewhere as well. What did Elder Holland say that caused such a stir?
In his speech to the faculty and staff at BYU on Monday, Elder Holland talked about the unique mission of the school, but what was particularly controversial is two aspects. One is he just said that there's a lot of division in the school and in the country, and kind of pointed to a valedictorian who gave a speech in 2019, I want to say, in which he came out as gay.
Yeah.
And that caused a huge furor. And
he said, I'm going to quote him here. He said that faculty and staff at BYU should take up their intellectual muskets to defend the quote, doctrine of the family and marriage as the union of a man and a woman.
Right.
And so, Peggy, is it that there are faculty and staff at the church-owned university who have been publicly supportive of the LGBTQ community there, and Elder Holland is saying that they shouldn't be doing that? Is that the sort of gist of this statement from Elder Holland?
Yeah, that is probably the most controversial aspect of the talk. Obviously, there are faculty who are supportive of their students who happen to be LGBT, but it's not clear whether those faculty are against the proclamation on the family or the idea of marriage between one man, a man and a woman, or whether they're just kind to their students. But apparently Elder Holland seems to believe there are faculty that aren't supportive of church doctrine on the family and encourage them to be better defenders of the faith.
Yeah. He talked about parents of students who are confused about what, quote, so much recent flag waving and parade holding on this issue means. As you said, he referenced that valedictorian's speech from a couple of years ago, in which he, I don't know if he came out in the speech or if he announced that he was gay to the student body at the time in the speech.
Yeah.
But that particular student was, I guess, a little bit taken aback or miffed by the statement that Elder Holland. Yeah. What did he?
Yes. Yeah, the flag waving in parades obviously alluded to rainbow flags, pride, you know, pride parades. That was also troubling to lots of people. And yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's what we should go to is the reaction both at BYU or, you know, inside of the church and out of the church and at the church-owned university, Brigham Young University. I mean, we should say, I guess, that Elder Holland also declared his unequivocal love for those who are living with what he referred to as, quote, this same-sex challenge, unquote. So expressing love, but describing it in a way that I think many LGBTQ advocates would take umbrage with. But how have, you know, as you said, a lot of uproar, how has this been received by the broader community, maybe?
As far as I can tell from social media and from people who send me emails or call me, whatever, it just seemed like a profoundly harsh talk to lots of folks. Even though he declared his love, it didn't feel very loving to the gay community. And that's been, I think, really hard. Lots of people feel that Elder Holland is on their side, is empathetic, is a kind person. And this struck them as I said, as harsh. He also said that if the church's stance on same-sex marriage cost the university some professional affiliations, then so be it. And there's been a lot of uproar about that. Like, really, is Brigham Young University going to risk its professional relationships in the field of social work or the field of
sports,
psychology, any of those where the national accreditation organizations, if they say, no, we're not going to accredit you because of this, that will have a direct impact on students and faculty.
Right. I guess that's far more difficult than just simply the NCAA, which is what I would immediately jump to in my mind.
They would also hate that, though.
Yeah, they wouldn't like that as well. There are those, of course, who are, I'm sure, in favor of this. I mean, the church stance on people who are LGBTQ is, you know, is a sort of form of acceptance, but a requirement that they not act on their on who they are. I mean, can you talk about? Yeah.
Yes, it isn't so much that he said anything that hasn't been said before about the church's policy towards same-sex romance or relationships or anything. It just was that for most people, I think declaring that faculty who are sympathetic or students who question or need to be reined in or, you know, fired at with muskets. I mean, he used that really unfortunate musket metaphor at a time when LGBTQ people are literally physically attacked. So there was the unfortunate metaphor. There was the use of violence. I don't for a minute think Elder Holland was suggesting violence.
Right. Intellectual muskets is different than, you know, take up your guns. And yeah. I mean, it's a metaphor, but maybe an unfortunate one, as you said. I mean, the other thing about this, though, is that this is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and this is the church-owned institution. I guess I'm wondering if this can be all that surprising to people. I guess there are people who do want to see reform of the church, who want to see the church adapt to the modern times, so to speak. But the church is, I mean, the Elder Holland is saying, no, this is who we are, I guess. Is that doing away with the hopes that some people may have to change the church?
Yeah, I don't know about that. But a few months ago, I wrote a story titled, Is BYU Getting Too Liberal? And in that story, I interviewed a man who said that he was troubled because lots of Mormon kids out and about in the country grow up watching Modern Family and other shows where a gay couple seems absolutely normal and acceptable. And then they go to BYU and the faculty there don't dissuade them from that view. And that man loved Elder Holland's talk and said that so the reality is younger generation of Latter-day Saint young people don't have the same problem with same-sex marriage as their elders, and they accept those relationships as normal and healthy. And some of that could be why Elder Holland felt the need to say these things.
You spoke to a graduate of BYU who is a married gay man in Utah who said that it's too late to scale back the support for LGBTQ students that some staff and faculty, I guess, at Brigham Young University have exhibited, that if it's there and then you take it away, it becomes more apparent, basically. Can you talk about that, Peggy? I mean,
What I was trying to say, which is that that my research supports that gay man's assessment that the tide is turning in favor, even among very devout Latter-day Saint young people. The tide's already turned in terms of supporting same-sex relationships, romances, and marriage. And it's just really unlikely to change.
Hmm. The challenge here is that you have a younger generation coming up, but of course they are still, if they are adherents of the faith, you know, supposed to be following a certain creed. You know, there's people who abide rigidly by the tenets of the faith. There are those who are less rigid. It's not unique to Mormonism. It's just part of the sort of modern conversation that's occurring, and who knows where it's headed.
I think the issue is, in this case, is a groundswell of attitudinal changes, not necessarily behavioral changes. So churches can somehow control some behavior. A school can forbid premarital sex. A school can forbid any kind of expression of affection between people of the same sex. But a school can't stop young people from having that attitude. And ultimately, if the young people's attitudes become so out of sync with their leaders, they might leave. And that's happening.
Yeah. Has there been, Peggy, the opposite of what we've been describing, a lot of people or a fair amount of people who are saying, this is what we wanted to hear from someone like Elder Holland, we're so glad that he said it? I mean, has there been that response at all from, say, an older generation of Latter-day Saints?
Yeah, sure. There's the man in my story, Dan Ellsworth, represents a group of people who absolutely agree and think it's about time and that some top leader should have said this, and that the only way to stem this tide is more preaching about these things by people in authority, leaders, ecclesiastical leaders or school leaders. Jeff Holland is not only an apostle, he is a former president of BYU. Has a lot of credibility and is well regarded, and so people like Dan Ellsworth absolutely are cheering this speech, and so numbers, it's hard to say numbers, you know, there's just a lot of talk pro and con about it.
Yeah, I mean, there's that, it's sort of a tightrope, this tightrope walking of acceptance, but kind of not acceptance of people who are LGBTQ. I mean, love, but not full admittance because of the tenets of the faith. Again, it is a paradox. And Peggy, I mean, are there any specific actions at Brigham Young University that are expected to be taken as a result of this? Or
not that I know of. I mean, we'll be watching, but it's too new, just happened this week. And there's a lot of anxiety and fear that some faculty might be in danger of being fired, or they might implement some kind of test of, you know, loyalty test or something. But none of that's come to be yet. But we'll be watching.
Okay. Peggy Fletcher Stack, religion reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks again for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And yeah, that was Peggy Fletcher Stack, religion reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough. You're tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. And George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist with the paper. This story, you know, these comments by Elder Holland, they caused quite a stir, but it's interesting. I think that for some people, it's kind of a peripheral story for those who aren't in the church or who aren't necessarily connected to BYU. But it's a very central story for those who do have those connections. And the impacts of these statements by Elder Holland, you know, do you want to add your thoughts on this story before we move on to other news? We're kind of running low on time here, actually.
Well, just that this is another example of the struggle that the LDS Church and a lot of religious groups have to keep their younger generations. The studies that are being done indicate that fewer and fewer people in the millennials and the Z generation follow any religious faith. They're referred to as the nuns because they are a member of no religious group. Those numbers are growing, and the schism over such issues as same-sex marriage and equality for women are a huge part of what's driving that.
I guess, you know what, I'm gonna plow us forward, George. I mean, this next story, I'm just gonna set it up. It might be considered an offshoot of that last story. It's that Natalie Klein, a conservative member of Utah's Board of Education, shared a photo of a pride flag, an LGBTQ pride flag that was hanging in an LDS seminary building. This is a seminary building connected to a Utah high school that is connected to the LDS church. And there was also a sign at the seminary itself that said, "If you are LGBTQIA, welcome to seminary." This school board member, Natalie Klein, didn't like that and said that it was time to make some phone calls. And she has also, as Courtney Tanner reported, previously stated her disapproval for any signs of acceptance of LGBTQ individuals in public schools. Anyway, other members of the school board now say that they're looking into this this Facebook post by Natalie Klein for potential violations of school board rules, and I think mainly because she didn't add a disclaimer that says, you know, this was her personal opinion and not the position of the school board. That's kind of the background. The Tribune didn't get a comment from Klein, I'll mention, and I'll note that she's actually taken this post down but left others up. And George, just to round all of this out, there was a statement by Troy Williams, executive director of Equality Utah, who said that Klein was leading a crusade against the LGBTQ community and that she was inciting what he called moral panic among parents. Before we head to a break here, George, any comments on the fallout from this school board story?
Well, I mean, I would hate for it to become a fight over her right of free speech. She's an individual in America. She has the right to say what she wants. The state school board is understandably concerned that people might take what she says as the official position of the state board, which it clearly is not. And as with Elder Holland, this is another example of people who just don't understand that the train has left the station on the issue of in the broader society on the issue of equality for homosexual people, for same-sex marriage, for all that kind of stuff, and they're fighting this rear guard action, and it's going to go away basically probably with the next generation, but before it does, it has the potential to cause a lot of damage and a lot of very serious pain for individuals, violence and suicide included.
All right, that's George Pyle, editorial page editor with Tribune. And George, I'm sorry to cut you short, but we're going to head to another break in the show, and we'll come back with, we'll try and squeeze in one more story before we get to our underplayed stories of the week. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we spend the hour with the one, the only, Martin Yan. For 40 years, the host of Yan Can Cook has brought Chinese and Asian cuisines into the homes of Americans. We talk with him about his life and journey. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
Tune in Sunday at noon here on Utah Public Radio.
Make an appointment with Public Radio's favorite family doc on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health. It'll be a jam-packed hour on healthy living, including this recipe for
cold cucumber soup.
We always have a great time, so will you, on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX.
Tune in Sunday afternoon at 1 here on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW and joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Alistair Lee Beatsoy and George Pyle. It's our Friday morning local news roundup. And we are going to try and squeeze in just one more story really quickly from this past week in Utah news. And Alistair, it's a story that deserves more time than we're going to be able to give it. But it's that coronavirus cases are inching up on the Navajo Nation because of the Delta variant. But health officials there are in some ways better positioned to confront that threat than many U.S. states are. And why is that the case? Why is Navajo Nation in comparatively better shape, Alistair?
Well, thank you again. I think from the reporting that I was able to get this past week, it's due in part to the devastation that the Navajo people have experienced among us as people of the virus is just overall threat to us and just the loss of relatives. And I feel like if you were to go on to Navajo right now, you would probably every single Navajo would know another person that contracted the virus, recovered from it, or even just even died from it. And so I think that just seeing that real, seeing it play out in the community, but also just the infrastructure issues or the lack of it that exists in our communities is another factor. And then just the CDC guidance, which is, I feel like is more aligned with suburban America rather than tribal communities. So there's just a lot of gap in services and the infrastructure exists in what I call border towns, or what Navajo or Dene people would call border towns, Gallup, Farmington, Blanding, Page, Flagstaff. Those are towns that get our money. And I feel like those towns are where maybe they're a little bit softer, or maybe more the virus doesn't really impact us, but they have the infrastructure to maintain isolation or quarantine.
Right.
And so there's a lot of different factors that play a role, but I feel like the Navajo Nation public health officials have done a magnificent job of really enforcing being innovative and using their knowledge as practitioners, but also cultural knowledge to enforce stricter public health measures than seen in nearby states. And so I feel like that's important to why. And then just the fact that there are campaigns that exist in the communities to get vaccinated. And so I feel like one of the trials too, the Pfizer trial early in the pandemic was on Navajo. So you got to see some of the science working in the Navajo population with the vaccine. So I feel like all of that was science. And I know from my understanding too, we have medicine healers in our communities too. And so some people consulted with our healers, whether it was would they take the vaccine or is it friendly to the body? And so some of those cultural guidances were taken into consideration before some people considered taking the vaccine, either Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, or the Pfizer. And I feel like the data collection is also even better than earlier in the pandemic. So public health officials are also able to basically send resources to communities that are amidst a surge. And the Delta variant is no different. It is surging in our communities right now.
Yeah.
And those are some of the factors.
Yeah. I hate to cut you off. We are so low on time. I just want to mention a couple of things. One is that, you know, vaccine acceptance seems to be higher on Navajo Nation than it is in many U.S. states. Public health measures like mask wearing, from your reporting, seem like they're being taken more seriously there. This is a really remarkable story, and unfortunately, we're out of time and we can't keep plowing through it. But I will urge people to go check it out at sltrib.com. And Alistair, thank you for reporting on this. And George Pyle, yeah, you know, I would ask for your comments. It seems like Navajo Nation might have a kind of enviable approach to the pandemic. And there's some really interesting comments from President Jonathan Nez in Alistair's story as well that people should check out at sltrip.com. But with that, we will turn to our final segment of the show, Underplayed Stories of the Week. And George, I know you don't like the title, but why don't you give us your pick for Underplayed Story?
Well, I want to just mention that we were talking a little bit about the pandemic. Navajo Nation and the rest of our nation, we're not doing so well. Senator Mitt Romney came to see the editorial board the other day. He's always very gracious about coming to see us every year about this time. Congress is in a break. He and the two staff members he brought with him were both wearing masks the whole time. He talked up the need to wear masks, to take the vaccine. He said if he was still running Bain Capital, he would require all his employees to be vaccinated, not just to wear a mask. And he had absolutely no patience for people who say that wearing a mask or getting the vaccine interferes with anybody's liberty.
Okay.
So if you get these things, that gives you liberty.
Wow. Check that out. Well, that's really interesting. And George Pyle with the Salt Lake Tribune editorial board conveying that information. Alistair, do you have a quick pick for Underplayed Story of the Week as well?
I would say Zach Podmore's fossil fuel story that was published recently, that I think it's just getting lots of hits. I mean, I don't know if that's underplayed, but that was news to me when I was out in Zion in Southern Utah looking for stories there. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. So I'd highly recommend that read just because how it's all related to San Juan County, Utah, or just like the natural resource development happening in the state and wow, like how it's all connected to the rest of the world. I think that's interesting to read.
That's very cool. Check that out at sltrib.com. I will quickly plug a story by public lands and environment reporter Brian Maffley about the state of Utah increasing the quotas on how many cougars hunters can kill. The state says it's to boost populations of mule deer and bighorn sheep, but Maffley's article quotes people who say that the science isn't there to support that. It's an interesting read. Check it out at sltrib.com. Alistair Lee Bitsoy, George Pyle, both with Salt Lake Tribune, thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thank you.
Yep. That does it for the show. Find podcasts at kcpw.org and join us again next week.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from our members and Gem City Fine Foods, certified gluten-free cheesecakes and cakes in a variety of flavors, including chocolate torte and blueberry lemon. Available in select retailers. Information at gemcityfinefoods.com.
Utah Public Radio is a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSUFM Logan. Also heard at upr.org.